Filmmaker Charlie Min's documentary A Nightmare in Las Cruces, which details the unsolved bowling alley massacre from 1990, marks its 10th anniversary this year. The massacre itself is marking its 30th anniversary. Min recently re-released the film with new interviews and hosted screenings in El Paso and Las Cruces. Anniversaries are always a time of reflection, and in that spirit, Charlie is today's on-film guest, where he'll delve into his career, film inspirations, and what drew him to the crime that would eventually become one of his first films. I'm Kyle Alvarado, sitting in for Charles Horak, and welcome to On Film. All right, so morning, Charlie.
How are you?
Pretty good. So the last time we talked was in 2017 when you were promoting Bullets at the Border. Since we're here to discuss the anniversary of the film, I thought it'd be a good time to kind of focus on you and reflect on your career as a filmmaker. So just starting right off, who are some of your filmmaking influences and how did you come to define your filmmaking style?
I only had one filmmaker that I really looked up to, and that was three-time Oscar winner Oliver Stone. I could honestly say that it's because of him that I became a filmmaker. What really drew me to his work was just the power and the emotion in his movies, not just as a director, but as a writer. Oliver won an Oscar when he was 32 years of age for Midnight Express, just a harrowing film that was released in 1978. And I'll never forget, that was like the first film that I saw that absolutely abused me. But it changed my mind. And it's a true story about a kid from Long Island who made a big mistake and paid a dear consequence for it. And then I started studying other Oliver Stone screenplays like Scarface, Platoon. So you don't watch Oliver's films, you feel them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is very true. And as you've, you know, how did you take sort of that filmmaking influence and sort of translate it to documentary film?
Well, I spent 10 years as a journalist. I worked on the news as an anchor reporter. So that's one thing I had going for me was my experience interviewing people, because interviews are the crux of the documentary, at least my style with my true crime documentaries that represent victims. So I developed a skill set where I could sit down with someone and ask them relevant questions. And yeah, I mean, just finding people like police, victims, family members, witnesses.
Building the relationship.
Yeah, that's really my strength. People always ask me, how in the world did you sit down with that person or this person? And I'm lucky, you know, I'm in a Google era now where people can just Google your name and right away there's trust established. So I always tell emerging filmmakers, always try to do interviews with the media, because that could eventually get on your Google page. If someone tries to Google you and nothing comes up, there's less trust. So you really got to build your Google. I call it BYG. And that's the advice I give filmmakers is you can never do enough interviews.
Mm, very true. At what point did you realize that filmmaking would be a sustainable career for you?
I didn't know that until the success of A Nightmare in Las Cruces. If that movie didn't hit, I honestly would have been back in New York so quickly and I wouldn't have even known what hit me. I mean, that movie was just an independent success. The fact that it was sold to Lionsgate really solidified my career. I got lucky, I'll admit it. The support from the borderland was extreme between El Paso and Las Cruces. We had a screening for the movie last Monday on the 30-year anniversary. Over 600 people came out in one night. So the support I've gotten here, I mean, I've said it countless times. I'm a nothing without the support of the Las Cruces and El Pasoans. I'm a nothing. My career started here. Wherever I end up, whether it's New York or L.A. or I don't know where my career is going to go from here, El Paso, Las Cruces, Juarez will always be deep in my heart.
Mm-hmm. Do you, you know, in addition to feeling responsibility to, you know, the victims of the crimes and the survivors of these shootings and the other, you know, crimes you make films on, do you feel any other sort of sense of responsibility to the region in terms of how, you know, you project its story out to the world?
My films are victim-driven. I don't even mention the killer's name in my movies because I think the killers, that's what they want is attention, and I think that creates copycats. I often blame the media, actually, for some of these mass murders that happen because they keep glorifying the killer. They keep mentioning his name all the time. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but lately there's been less focus in on the killer. And I don't want to take any credit for that. I mean, the bottom line is we need less attention on the killer. We need no attention on the killer, actually. If you want to talk about the killer, call the killer Killer X. Just don't say his name. So my focus is on victims, what they go through, how they somehow gather the strength to get through such an impossible period in their lives. So I am completely a victim's advocate. I've been criticized for being too pro-victim because then people think I'm blaming the police too much because I'm so pro-victim. I have nothing against the police. I mean, probably one of my best films is about a policeman in Mexico, Mexico's bravest man. So I'm not anti-police. I'm anti-injustice. Mm. So if a police does a great job, I'll be the first one to say it. If they don't, then I'll be the first one to say that as well.
Mm. So kind of switching to the business side of it, the last time we spoke, you had mentioned that the advent of streaming has rapidly expanded how your films are consumed. How have you navigated the business side of streaming and distribution on those platforms?
Well, I got lucky there again. I mean, I think a filmmaker works hard, they get luckier. So what happened was about 4 years ago, I got a call out of the blue. This person, he's like an aggregator. He said, you know, boy, I've heard a lot of things about your movies. I think it's about time we put them on Amazon and all these streaming services that has really taken over the filmmaking world. Movie theaters and box offices are not as important now because of the streaming option. So I studied this guy. I studied the company. I put my trust into them. They obviously trusted me. And now there's 20 movies placed on Amazon Prime. And my career, my life changed because of that. I'm able to make any film I want. I don't have to go outside and look for money. I can finance it myself if need be. But I know every filmmaker, you know, I tell them, fall under OPM, other people's money. I mean, you never want to put up your own, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I feel fortunate. I really do. I mean, I could fund my own film. Getting investors is getting easier. So I feel like I'm in a good place right now through all that hard work.
And had it always been kind of an upward trajectory for you, or had there been sort of bumps in the road?
I would say I got off to a really surprising start for myself. I mean, Nightmare in Las Cruces was sold to Lionsgate. My second film, Eight Murders a Day, played in 30 U.S. cities. And then I kind of tailed off like slightly. I mean, nothing bad. I mean, I've made 31 films, and I think 28 of them have made money. So that's a pretty good percentage. But I would say since 2017, because of the Amazon explosion, my career is peaking, and I feel fortunate. I mean, I've worked hard, but you also need some luck thrown in there.
Yeah. So kind of removing it from the streaming aspect of it, do you have any advice for filmmakers who are just barely beginning to navigate kind of the business side of filmmaking?
You got to be aggressive. You have to try to maybe find a mentor. I mean, I think today a lot of filmmakers make mistakes. They don't really know the business side. You know, my formula is very unique. I don't really do many film festivals. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of them are kind of on the low end and cheap. And filmmakers have to be careful. Just because it's a film festival doesn't mean that you have to be in that film festival. To me, a film festival has to further your career in some way. And if you're going to throw your movie into a film festival and there's only 10 people watching it and it's your mom and dad and your friends patting you on the back all the time, I don't think that really does anything for your career.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I look into a film festival, I want to know that there's distributors there, there's buyers there, there are people that could take your career to the next level. Obviously, Sundance, Toronto, Cannes, very difficult festivals to get into.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, with my formula, sure, a great film festival would help. But right now, my formula is going well that I'm okay with where I'm at right now.
Mm. Do you think a formula like that can be, you know, not copied exactly because it's, you know, it's your formula, but do you think there's other aspects, you know, maybe for horror filmmakers to sort of find an entry point through a similar formula in terms of distribution and partners?
Well, I mean, I do true crime documentaries. In terms of a horror film, I mean, I guess you could try to place those films on Amazon as well. But you also have to be careful because just because the film's on Amazon doesn't mean it's going to be watched.
Mm.
I mean, I'm very lucky. You know, between my 20 films on Amazon, I think I have over 1,300 comments. So you know people are buying it. It's a purchase and people are commenting on your work. Sometimes I see films up there with like no comments.
Mm.
So just because your film's on Amazon doesn't mean you're going to take your career to the next level.
Yeah.
You still have to market. You still have to get everything out there with interviews, with the media. So I've been very lucky. I've done national interviews, the El Paso local media and the Las Cruces media. They've covered my movies. So you just have to keep working hard.
So turning to the film, Nightmare in Las Cruces, in a previous interview, you mentioned that you came across the bowling alley massacre while watching Unsolved Mysteries and the rest is history. Can you walk me through what your mind went through, you know, when you initially decided to pursue the film and what those first few weeks of research were like?
It was summer 2009 and I had reached a fork in the road in my life. I mean, I was kind of, I mean, my career and my life was actually in trouble. I didn't know what to do next. I had worked as a journalist for 10 years, and then I kind of dabbled in acting. And I made some short films. I don't think they were very good. So as recently as 10 years ago, 11 years ago, honestly, I was in trouble. I mean, I had to really look in the mirror, make some tough decisions. And the nightmare in Las Cruces, the bowling alley massacre, had always been somewhere in my mind. So I looked at it again and I said, wow, 20 years is coming up. And as you said earlier, anniversaries are a time of reflection. So this case hadn't been solved, still is not solved. And I said to myself, I don't know what got into me, but that was a moment. I just said, you know, I think I can make a documentary on this. I just like one day woke up and said that without ever making a documentary before. So this was raw. This was self-taught. All I had was my passion and my experience as a news anchor asking questions. So I was so passionate about the case that I just wanted to dive into it and do a great job. And so I flew into El Paso fall of 2009, didn't know anybody. I've landed in El Paso airport. Someone picked me up, took me to Las Cruces. I put an ad in Craigslist. And then here we are, 10 years later, 31 films. I've sold films to Lionsgate, Investigation Discovery, worked at NBC, done films for Lifetime, 20 films on Amazon, produced for America's Most Wanted. I feel good about what I've done, and it's through hard work and luck. And I owe everything to the Bowling Alley Massacre film because that's what launched my career.
Mm. So we've got time for one more question. Do you have any projects that are in development or ready for release, actually?
Yeah, 7 Murders a Day, which examines the hyperviolence in Tijuana. Tijuana became the murder capital of the world 2 years ago. That movie will be out next Friday, the 21st of February, at Bassett. It's going to run for at least a week. For more information, 7murdersaday.com, 7 the number. And Bassett has completely renovated itself. It has all recliners. The 17 screens are back up and running. They were down for a while there because they were going through construction. But the recliner seats are in. It has a total new feel to it. So I love Bassett. It's so centrally located, closest theater to Ciudad Juarez. And I'm also developing the project called 915, which is about the Walmart mass shooting. That will be out on the one-year anniversary, actually a couple days before, July 30th at Bassett. We've done 17 interviews. They're absolutely gut-wrenching. And I think 95% of El Pasoans don't really have a true feel on what happened that day. They know something horrible happened. They may have seen some of the bodies laying outside the Walmart on Facebook Live, but they don't know who these people are that are laying down, that are laying there. So we interviewed a lot of those people that survived, direct eyewitnesses, people who had been shot, family members. This film is certainly going to be emotional.
My guest today has been documentarian Charlie Min, whose early film, A Nightmare on Las Cruces, marks its 10th anniversary this year. The massacre itself is marking its 30th anniversary. The film was re-released in area theaters with additional interviews edited in. The film is available to rent on YouTube, Google Play, Prime Video, iTunes, and Vudu. On Film's producer and engineer is Victoria Almujer. An archive of past programs can be found at ktep.org. I'm Kyle Alvarado, sitting in for Charles Horak, and thank you for joining me for On Film.